Right now, it's our weekly look at the top state news from last week.
Today, in a federal appeals court in Chicago, Wisconsin's controversial voter ID law is getting a hearing, along with other election-related laws. A panel of three federal judges will hear arguments from both sides to determine whether or not to bring back restrictions on early voting and how to deal with people who have trouble getting IDs.
Laurel White has been covering this story, and she joins us now to share the details of this and other top news from the past week. She's Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us, what is this appeals court in Chicago looking at?
Well, the appeals court in Chicago is hearing two different Wisconsin election law cases, or they heard them this morning, rather. So one is Frank v. Walker. That's a five-year-old case that's obviously been around for a while. It's gone through several appeals. And then the One Wisconsin Institute versus Thompson case, which is younger. I believe that one kicked off in 2015. So these looked at a variety of issues from election-related laws like early voting to Wisconsin's voter ID law.
And particularly, what do we know about the direction the court seems to be leaning based on what we've heard so far?
Well, you know, this was a three-judge panel, so it wasn't the entire Seventh Circuit, as you mentioned before. It might be pertinent to mention that all three of these judges were appointed by Republican presidents. And some of the comments that they made today were pretty critical, particularly in that One Wisconsin Institute versus Thompson case. And that's the case that's looking at more than a dozen of Wisconsin's election laws. And a verdict came down from a district court last summer. And kind of the biggest thing that that district court verdict did was to knock down some restrictions that had been put in place on early voting. So, for example, the number of locations or hours that local governments could offer people to go and vote before Election Day. Those restrictions have been put in place since 2011. The court said those aren't appropriate. And what we heard from, you know, really all of the judges today on the appellate court was that they didn't find that ruling very compelling. They didn't really think that it held up. Their questioning was pretty harsh. So we don't know officially, of course, what their ruling is going to be for another few weeks or maybe even a few months. But it seems like they're leaning toward, anyway, reversing that district court opinion.
And what would be the next step as Wisconsin's voter ID law makes its way through the court? What happens for the side that loses?
Sure. So whichever side loses this appeal, they can take it to the next level. These things continue. They've been going on for quite a while, and we expect them to keep going. They can try to appeal to the full appellate court, so all of the judges rather than just the three-judge panel, or they could appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, it sounds like whatever happens, it would not affect the election in Wisconsin coming up in April, but it sounds like it could have the potential to impact some bigger races a year out.
That's right. Yeah, courts are really hesitant to rule too close to an election. So I think folks would be really surprised if a verdict came down before April that would make any changes. I think it's probably going to be after that and, like you said, affect elections a little further down the line.
Now, on Wednesday, President Trump's administration rolled back guidance from the Obama administration that was directing schools to let students decide which bathroom to use based on gender identity as opposed to biological gender or sex. What kind of reaction do you see to that in Wisconsin?
So I spoke with advocates and school officials and government officials yesterday about the Trump administration's action. And pretty much across the board, all of these folks said that schools need to continue to do what they can to provide safe and supportive and inclusive environments for students, and that includes transgender students.
And you spoke with someone from GSAVE, which is a transgender advocacy group, and here's what he had to say.
The sky hasn't fallen. The educators are very good at figuring out how to maintain the dignity, respect, and safety of all students.
And Laurel, what did we hear there?
Yeah, so that was Brian Jukums. He's the education and policy director for GSAFE, and he goes into a lot of schools and helps them kind of craft and work their way through these transgender bathroom policies, providing support and guidance. And as you heard there, he doesn't expect the Trump administration's action to have too much of an effect on schools that already have policies in place. And he actually said to me as well that he's working with some districts that are crafting policies right now, and he doesn't expect them to step anything back or to abandon that work.
What did you hear about whether or not, you know, aside from the legal aspects, that this could change the atmosphere, the way students felt in their own schools?
So I spoke with the superintendent of a school that's in the Fox Cities region of the state, and he said that they're not planning to change their policy. The policy's been in place for a couple years, but he said he did expect it to be kind of an uncomfortable time for some of his students, some of the families in the district, just because there's a national conversation about this now, and it's kind of drawing attention and possibly criticism. Students might not feel as supported. I spoke to a school board member from a school board that's in the Milwaukee suburbs, and she really echoed those sentiments. She said that students might have a hard time for a little bit now, maybe focusing on their schoolwork as something that's so personal and so sensitive has kind of been brought into the light.
We're looking back at the big news from the past week in Wisconsin right now with Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, and we'll pick up with her in just a bit.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion now with State Capitol reporter Laurel White talking about the big news from the past week here in Wisconsin. And Laurel, veterans called on Governor Scott Walker and Republican lawmakers on Wednesday to leave their plans to repeal prevailing wage laws for state projects in Wisconsin. What did the veterans have to say about why they wanted that?
Well, veterans are saying that they would be adversely affected by the repeal of this law. Veterans, you may or may not know, according to the American Legion of Wisconsin, for example, work disproportionately in construction, more than other folks. So they return from service and they often pursue construction jobs. So they say that the repeal of the prevailing wage law for state construction projects would really adversely affect them.
And here's a clip from one veteran who spoke at the hearing.
When we come back from our tour duty and combat, we don't want to fight here no more.
And Laurel, tell us more about that hearing and what we just heard.
So that was Leroy Miller. He's an Army veteran who works in construction now. He was one of more than a dozen veterans that were present at this press conference in the Capitol. I believe that was Wednesday. And there were several other representatives from organizations. I think I mentioned the American Legion of Wisconsin. A department commander for the American Legion during the press conference said, why is it that always the budget is balanced on the backs of veterans? So pretty strong language during this press conference. There were some other American Legion officials there who expressed some optimism. They said that the governor has traditionally been, you know, quote, on the side of veterans. So they're optimistic that now that they've voiced a strong opinion about this pending legislation, that the governor will withdraw his support and kind of change course on this.
So we'll watch that as it continues to evolve. And in another story, Laurel, on Tuesday, lawmakers held a hearing on the Transportation Department audit that came out last month. And what came out didn't cast the DOT in the best light.
It didn't. And this was a really highly anticipated audit. Lawmakers had been waiting for months to hear what the nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau had to say about the State Department of Transportation. Just really quickly, a summary of that audit for folks who might not be familiar. The biggest takeaway was that it found the DOT has been underestimating the cost of projects, primarily because they haven't been factoring in inflation into their project cost estimates. It also highlighted some things like the DOT failing to meet its own performance metrics and, you know, kind of continued to talk about something that we've heard a lot in recent years is that road conditions across the state are deteriorating.
And here's a bit from new State Department of Transportation Secretary Dave Ross.
We need to change the culture at DOT. We need to become more performance driven. We need to become more accurate.
And Secretary Ross there looking at some future, hopefully, behaviors, he says, for the DOT. But there were also some specific recommendations made. Tell us about those, Laurel.
Yeah, so Secretary Ross is really, he's new to this position. He just took over for former Secretary Mark Gottlieb last month in early January. And so he was kind of in a unique position to start fresh and say, we're going to take these recommendations that are in the report. Those recommendations are really wide ranging. So they go from sort of recommendations on project management, on how the DOT takes in bids for contracts, how they monitor projects as they're going along, kind of things like that. And then also legislative recommendations. So basically bills that the legislature could pass to put new practices in place at the DOT that are mandated by law.
And Laurel, we've got a new budget in play. It is not set in stone. What sort of effect could this audit have on the DOT's ask this year?
Well, that was a really prominent part of this hearing that was held this week on this DOT audit. There were several lawmakers on this committee, and they weighed in with different opinions on what this audit might mean for the budget. Representative John Nygren, who's a chair of the Budget Writing Committee, so a very powerful lawmaker and has a lot of power over the state budget, he said that, you know, the DOT underestimating project costs might mean that they need even more money than they've asked for. There's been a projected shortfall of about $1 billion for the State Transportation Department. And Representative Nygren said, well, maybe that projection of a $1 billion shortfall is too small. Maybe the shortfall is even bigger. On the other side of that, Senator Chris Kapinga from Delafield said, the DOT hasn't been handling its money well. It hasn't been estimating project costs correctly. They're not prioritizing projects properly. Going and giving them more money at this point, in Kapinga's exact words, he said would be the absolute wrong thing to do. So two very different sides of the debate on what this audit might mean for DOT.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us and getting us up to date.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That was Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, with us there to round up the top state news stories for the past week here in Wisconsin.
Coming up after the news, a look back at the career and legacy of a Wisconsin musical legend, the original funky drummer, Clyde Stubblefield.
Right now, don't forget, Wisconsin Public Radio's winter membership drive is going on. You can make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. That's Cold Sweat by James Brown featuring Clyde Stubblefield, the original funky drummer. Clyde passed away last weekend in Madison. And as Wisconsin remembers his music and his career, we've invited a longtime friend and fellow drummer for a look at his life and his music.
Stubblefield was a legend in the music world for his work with James Brown and beyond. He moved to Madison in 1971. He's well known to Wisconsin Public Radio listeners for his work on What Do You Know? Joey B. Banks joins us. He's a drummer based in Madison. He worked with Clyde on musical projects and a scholarship fund. Joey is at a memorial event that starts at 5. He talked to us in the studio earlier today. Joey, thanks for joining us again on Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us about when you first met Clyde Stubblefield?
I've been telling this story a lot lately.
Yeah.
I think it was I was 16 years old and clubbed Wash. There was Paul Black was doing his Monday blues jam, and I was a kid sneaking in to the club to watch, basically, and jamming with those guys. And Clyde happened to be there and saw me play and complimented me on what I was doing. And really, from that point on, I had really a lot of positive things to say about my playing, but it was a club to watch.
What was that like being 16? I can only imagine, you know, being a musician myself, having this legend come in and say, yeah, sounds good. I mean, that I would just pass out probably.
It made me smile. I mean, I think a couple other interviews I've had, that was the inspiration that really kind of got me thinking, you know, I might want to do this and for my entire life. I want to be a drummer. And actually that year I did start playing professionally in Madison. I started playing with Charlie Brooks in his band. So It definitely inspired me, and it definitely motivated me and gave me the confidence to be a drummer.
So it inspired your career in part, but you've also worked with Clyde really ever since then. Can you talk about working with him on, you know, in his band in town and just a lot of other projects over the years?
Yeah. I mean, the beginning of me really working with Clyde and becoming close with him is when he got sick the first time. And I started subbing for him about 20 years ago for his Funky Monday shows. And I subbed for him on a few outside shows as well. But more recently, Clyde was sick, 3 years ago. He was hospitalized, hadn't played for a couple years. And I really wanted to do something, to get him back behind the drums. And that's kind of what the whole thing was the last time I was in the studio. We were with Clyde talking about the band and getting the band back together and having him play. And it was kind of him coming back to playing again. But over the years, it was just subbing for him a lot when he was sick and covering for him. And then recently forming the revitalization of the Clyde Stubblefield All-Stars and the Funky Mondays. And we got all that going again. And the band's going to continue, actually. We're going to continue to do Funky Mondays. We're going to continue to do the Clyde Stubblefield tribute. And we're going to continue to support the Clyde Stubblefield Scholarship Fund through that Funky Monday event.
Let's talk about Clyde Stubblefield as a musician. What made him such a groundbreaking drummer?
He completely unique style of playing really lended him to be, I consider him to be the father of the funk movement and the whole funk genre. I think his Cold Sweat tune was an R&B number one hit, and it kind of pushed James Brown and that style of funk into the pop mainstream.
Can you talk on a technical level? What stuff was he doing that made it?
What
so
stuff?
If you want to be nerd out as a drummer for a minute.
Nerd out, his left hand independence and syncopation of his left hand technique and quality of that left hand.
So that's hitting the hi-hat and the cymbals.
Not his hi-hat at all, his left hand.
Okay. The whole left hand.
His left hand is the mastery is coming from his left hand.
Okay.
I teach a lot of my students a lot of that left hand independence. It's very unique and it's very syncopated and it's exclusive to him. I mean, and it really actually, to be honest, is the blueprint for a lot of funk drummers' basic funk concept. I mean, he's in every funk drummer's vocabulary.
If you're learning to play today, you're going to play along with the track that he recorded.
Absolutely. I mean, anything that you hear, I mean, I remember as a young kid, a 6-year-old kid, and my mom and dad listening to Clyde Stubblefield. That's the only funk that I remember. I always associated any type of funk rhythm with whatever Clyde's rhythms were.
And his rhythms were key to the rise of rap and hip hop.
Yeah.
Heavily sampled, right? He had, I know, mixed feelings about that. I think he liked the tribute. He didn't like that he wasn't getting paid for it, though, which was a bad thing.
Actually, that's not totally true. I mean, I don't think the money has never been an issue with him. It was recognition. It was Public Enemy saying, this is Clyde Stubblefield's beat on Fight to Power. You know, it's the artist that's sampling that beat, giving him credit for that beat is what he wanted. And I think if that would have happened, I think things would have been a lot different for him monetarily.
And hip hop, would it be what it is without his beats?
Absolutely not. Hip hop would not exist without his beats, in my opinion. I mean, he's the most sampled. He's still being sampled. And I'm sure now that he's gone, he's going to be sampled even more. But he's the father of two genres, without a doubt.
Talking to Joey B. Banks. He's a drummer. He's a longtime friend. He's worked with Clyde Stubblefield, looking back at Clyde's life and career. What led Clyde to Wisconsin?
You know, his brother, Frank, was here, and he came to visit him back in, 70, 71, and he loved Madison. He loved being here, and he loved the people right away, right off the bat. And he decided to make Madison his home. It was really his brother, Frank, who has passed away a couple of years ago, who got him here.
Now, a lot of my colleagues here at WPR knew him better than I do. He worked on, of course, What Do You Know? Mm-hmm. I only got to meet him the once with you when we interviewed him here in the studio. What struck me is that, okay, here's this legend. I'm in the studio with this legend. The most humble guy. He would not brag about anything. I had to get you to brag about him. Is that right? Was that a right impression of him?
Yeah, that's one of the qualities about him that everybody knows is humility and being humble. And he's extremely loyal friend to the people around him. He really... was the most humble person that I've ever met by far. Drummers all over the world, internationally for years, I've idolized him and were inspired by him. And he's just a regular guy from Chattanooga, Tennessee. I consider him more of a Madisonian than a person from Tennessee. He's lived here for 40 years, more than the most time in his life. But, he's truly humble, and that was probably one of the biggest and most gracious qualities about him.
We in Wisconsin are lucky to have had access, big clubs and small, to just be there. And oh, hey, there's Clyde Stubblefield playing a set. What was it like to see him live?
Well, I had pretty unique vantage point.
Sure.
playing right next to him and being the musical director of his group, and I don't remember not smiling sitting next to him. It was just a constant smile, watching him smile. I think one of the most gratifying feelings I had was getting him back behind the kit and watching him smile and be happy, because I think he was the most happy when he was playing drums. And I'm happy that I could be a part of getting him back behind it. But you know, it unique perspective of being right next to him and sharing the stage with him on a regular basis is the highest honor and privilege that I could have.
What was it like that time he'd been, as you said, he hadn't been playing live for a while, that first show when he came back and played?
The first show was tempos were slow. we had some rehearsals, and he would tell you, he would never, ever, ever, ever rehearse. And I had convinced him he had to rehearse for the band's sake, because we really had to have some organization in the songs. And he resisted, but he finally did it. And in those first couple of rehearsals, he'd get through a couple of tunes, and he'd be, a little sore, and he'd be coughing, and he's really, really worn. And the first couple of shows really tried to take it easy on him, but tempos were slow. And there's a scholarship CD from the Barrymore show that we did. You listen to it, some of the tempos were a little slow, but over the next two or three months, he got really strong, and he got back to playing again. And his manager, Kathy, started booking him a little more frequently outside of the Madison area. I mean, a month before he passed, he was in Nashville with Jabbo and the JBs. He was at Guitar Center's Grand Finals playing, and they did a tribute to him there, and put his hands in their Wall of Fame.
Great.
And then he was honored at NAMM a few weeks back with Yamaha. So he was playing all the way to the end.
You mentioned the scholarship fund that he worked on, and you've worked on it with him, and he encouraged you as a youth. Was it important to him to pass the baton, or I guess the drumstick, to the next generation?
I think so. I mean, I think just naturally. I mean, he just had a natural want to support local musicians and local artist, and he would get people on stage frequently at Funky Mondays. Maybe not the most talented people on stage, but he would give them chances. I've been a big advocate of youth as well over the years as an educator, and at Funky Mondays frequently brought up my students to sit in with Clyde and sit in with the band. I just thought it was important for them to be able to have that opportunity, and Clyde loved it. Clyde loved having the youth and the kids come up and perform, and he supported that. I think he wanted to do more of that. He expressed that quite a bit to me, that he wanted to work with kids and he wanted to have influence on the next generation. And he has. He's going to have it through me and through my educational efforts. But he definitely cared about everybody. He wanted to give everybody a shot.
And the scholarship fund, I imagine that's going to continue?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we just, the Coalition for the Recognition of Clyde Stubblefield just partnered with the Madison Area Music Association to start the Madison Area Music Association Clyde Stubblefield Scholarship Fund that will help send kids that want to study music, support kids that want to study music in college. So that's going right now. We're on a heavy fundraising mission for that to get to endowment status. So that we can start awarding scholarship money this upcoming Madison Area Music Award show.
And memorial events, what's going on?
Memorial event, the first one of is today, Friday. It will be at the Concourse Grand Ballroom and from 5 to 8, and it'll be officiated by Michael Feldman.
Mm-hmm.
So that's today, and then the musical tribute I'm putting together is on Monday at the High Noon Saloon from 6 to 10. I think it's going to be 6 to whenever.
Sure.
Kathy at the High Noon has given us the room, pretty much donated the room to us for that event. And we'll have lots of memorabilia for people to purchase. A lot of that money will be going to the family, Jody Hannon, his wife, and the scholarship fund. So, you know, we're going to do all Clyde Stubblefield hits, and we're going to do some Clyde Stubblefield original material from his albums and then some of his favorite cover tunes that we've done on Mondays for the last 18 months.
Well, thank you, Joey, so much. Sorry for your loss, for WPR's loss, for the music world's loss, too.
Absolutely. It's a little bit of a hole in the soul of Madison's music community right now, and I'm hoping that we can heal a little bit of that on Monday at the musical tribute. He would want us to party. He's a partier, and he'd love to have a good time, and that's how we want to represent the tribute. We want it to be an uplifting, happy, healing experience for everybody that's involved.
Thanks again for coming up, Joey.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That was drummer Joey B. Banks. He joined us in the studio earlier today for a look at the music and life of Clyde Stubblefield.